Mental illness is epidemic in America, and the problem is spreading worldwide. It's time for decisive action, because the battle for the mind is part of a much larger war being waged between good and evil, with you as the prize. Welcome to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. For the next hour, we'll uncover Bible-based weapons for fighting destructive feelings and resolving inner conflicts. Dr. Jennings wants to arm you with the tools necessary for achieving emotional and mental stability as you strengthen your relationship with God. I'm your Simple Solutions host, Charles Mills.
When God hand-wrote the Ten Commandments and then hand-delivered them to Moses atop smoldering Mount Sinai, he did more than outline in stone how future generations of Jews and Christians should act. He also handed down a set of rules that would guard the health of their brains. That's right. There's a psychological element to each and every commandment, elements that will help bring healing and restoration to any sinned, sickened mind. I've asked Dr. Jennings to dig into these commandments and share with us how applying them to our lives can actually bring optimum health to our brains. Dr. Jennings, before we begin examining the commandments one by one, what's your feeling on why God needed to so dramatically deliver these words of love to the children of Israel? Why all the smoke, thunder, and drama?
Because of the mindset of the people at that time, it was a way of getting their attention and letting them know that this was something serious. These people had just come out of 400 years of slavery, and life was very cheap at that point. I mean, it was a very sad circumstance that in order to communicate the concept of love, you would have to say, hey, if you love somebody, you know, don't kill them, and if you love somebody, don't steal from them, and so forth. So God had to write these things down because they were very primitive in their understanding of what love was all about and how to treat each other.
Does God do that today? Are there any dramas that God brings into our skies and into our mountaintops today? Have you noticed any?
I can't say that I have actually seen a thundering at Sinai and God's presence descending happening on earth today in that manner. So God intervenes in each of our lives to us personally in ways that are designed to get our attention, but I haven't seen anything that dramatic.
I guess we could say probably then, Dr. Jennings, that sometimes we experience personal Sinais. Would that be a good explanation of that?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things I want to mention is your opening about the commandments and their psychological effect. You indicated they have a psychological healing effect on us, but we need to talk about that's only if they are done freely.
Mm.
If you obey the commandments of God from a sense of obligation, because you feel under pressure or coercion, because you feel under threat from a divine power, then you are actually harmed by that process psychologically.
So it actually, we must have a certain mindset before we dig into this, right?
See, we have to understand God's purpose of law, and the Bible is clear on that, that the law was given as a hedge of protection and as a schoolmaster to lead us somewhere. It was never designed, and Paul says in 1 Timothy that it was basically it's given for the wicked and the rebellious, not for the righteous. The point is, it's like an MRI scanner. It scans the character of an individual to reveal to that individual where they're sick, where there are defects in their character, heart, and mind. But the law can't fix anything. And one of the mistakes we make is when we consider that the written law has the capacity to somehow fix us, and so we try to work hard to obey the law under a sense of obligation, which only actually causes a sense of rebelliousness and hardness of heart. That doesn't mean we can live outside the law, though. We can't.
I like your analogy there of the MRI not healing you. It's a tool. It is something that identifies something else. And I guess the law would be the same thing then?
That's exactly right. Paul says in Romans that the law was given so that sin might abound. It was given so that it could expose in us how sick we are and convict us and then ultimately lead us back to Christ. And just like a hedge of protection, like you might put a training wheels on your child's bicycle or you might put a fence in your backyard to keep a child who isn't mature enough to know where to stop or where to go to give them the guidance and protection from hurting themselves. The Ten Commandments was also given for the purpose not just of diagnosing, but the purpose of hedging in and protecting us from destroying ourselves. So a child who obeys the commandments only because they're told to do so will have a certain level of benefit until they're old enough to appreciate the reasons why. A classic example would be a parent who has a rule for their child to brush their teeth. Now, as a child, they're brushing their teeth only because of the rule. But even though that's the only reason they're doing it, they are getting the benefit of keeping their teeth in good shape. Right. Later, however, they come to no longer need the rule because they understand the reasons why and they freely and actively do this, not because of a parental threat or because of some rule, but because they understand the purposes and reasons behind it and they do it freely.
All right. So as we come to the Ten Commandments today on this program, we need to realize that these are a diagnostic tool. And so God spoke 10 diagnostic tools to the children of Israel and to us down through the ages. And let's find out the brain connection that God had here. We know the physical connection. The first one, you shall have no other gods before me. Well, of course, the children of Israel understood about creating gods and making gods and bowing down to them and bringing them gifts. That was the physical element. Why did God make this particular commandment to heal their brains?
Yeah, because a lot of people have a misunderstanding about this. They say God is the sovereign, he is the creator, he is all-powerful, therefore it's his right to command us to worship him. And they make it about God's authority and or need for worship. That is not the reason why. You are on the right track with your question. Your question is, how does this command help our brain? And that's exactly the reason God gave it. Because there is a law in our psychological design. In psychiatry or psychology, it's called modeling. By beholding, we are actually changed. We assimilate or become like that which we idealize and worship. And therefore, being the highest created beings on planet Earth, God knew there was nothing on planet Earth that we could worship that would tend to our development and our growth. And in fact, if we worship anything on planet Earth, it only causes us to degrade. And therefore, because God loves us and wants our highest development, he tells us to worship him, because only in worshiping him can we continue to grow and advance to the highest pinnacles of development. Imagine what it would be like if you and your family worshiped the old ancient frog god of Egypt, and you guys gather around each day a little idol of a frog and pray to the little frog, asking the frog to bless you and help you to grow up to be like it one day. You see, there would be major problems in our development if we're worshiping a frog. So,
boy, there certainly would be.
So commandment development, our growth for our good.
Yeah, all right. And this folds right into the second commandment very clearly, and I see where you're going with this thing. Here's the second commandment. I'm reading from the New International Version of the Bible. Second commandment, you shall not make yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or in earth beneath or the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, punishing the children of the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. So you've talked about this before. I'm going to take a little bit of a stretch here. Television watching, sometimes the brain does not know the difference between real and unreal. Is it also true when people bow down to an idol, the brain actually thinks that that's a god?
Well, the brain believes what you choose to believe. If you choose to believe that that idol has power, then that idol will have power over you. Remember we said on the show before, we have power over what we believe, but our beliefs have power over us. Paul tells us in Romans 1 that they exchanged the truth of God for images made with their own hands, and their minds became darkened, their minds became futile, their minds became depraved. And so when we worship images that we make with our own hands, when we spend time worshiping TV or other things, it darkens our comprehension, and the science actually shows that television watching alters the brain wiring. So we overdevelop the emotion centers of the brain, and we underdevelop the centers of the brain that reason and think and problem solve and self-restrain. And so we're more prone to acting out in moodiness and irritability and so forth. This leads to actual gene changes, gene expression changes. And so in the commandment, it's very fascinating. God says, look, if you worship these other things, if you spend your time believing that a a frog or an idol has power, or watching TV, you will change yourself. You will be altered. Your mind will become darkened. And not only that, because of my design for humanity, I gave you the capacity to create beings in your image. What will happen is when you change yourself and darken yourself in this way, you're going to pass those changes along to your children down 3 and 4 generations. That's what's going to happen. And I love you and don't want that for you. So this commandment is designed to keep our mind focused on the things which cause us to develop in a healthy way, and we will pass healthy changes on to our kids 3 and 4 generations.
That is amazing. You've talked about this before on the show, this 3 or 4 generations. How does that work? How does one pass that down?
Well, the genes that we have, we don't just pass along the genes that we have. The genes also have instructions on how they are to be expressed, which genes are turned on, which genes are turned off, and what combination. And the instructions on which genes are turned on and turned off are constantly changing based on our choices, our beliefs, our life experiences. At age 5, identical twins will have 95% of their genes expressed exactly the same at age 5. By the time they're 70, those same identical twins have less than 5% of their genes expressed in the same way. While they have identical genes, the combination and constellation of how those genes are being expressed are no longer identical. Life experiences change them, and we pass those changed expression along to our children so that when they're born, they're not only born with the genes we give them, but they're born with the code of instructions of how those genes should be expressed, and that's what we pass along.
Is God holding us accountable for that second, third, and fourth generation?
I'm not sure what you mean by accountable.
Well, if you send expression that is damaging, that is evil to the next generation, does God hold you responsible for the sins of the next generation?
What do you mean by responsible?
Well, yeah, does God...
Are you saying that he's going to hold you up in a court of law, and then he's going to inflict some type of external penalty upon you for the fact that you did this?
Does God hold, maybe responsible is not the right word. Does God, no, I'm heading the wrong, I know where I'm going, I'm digging a hole here.
Maybe you should ask.
And I know where you want me to go, and I'm trying to figure out how to get
there. Will you be responsible?
Say that again?
Maybe you should ask the question, will you be responsible?
That's right. Will I be responsible? There you go.
Yes,
will I
be responsible. It's not relevant whether God holds you responsible or not. You are responsible for the changes you make in yourself. And those changes will then impact the generations to come behind you. And you are responsible for the changes you make in yourself to a degree, okay? And that is only to the degree that those changes have been made by free will choices of yourself. You see, a child who is sexually molested at age 3, 4, 5, and 6, are they responsible for the fact they were molested?
No. No.
No, but the fact they were molested will change their neural wiring and gene expression. We've well documented that brain changes and neural and genetic expression changes occur in children who are abused. And those expression changes result in physical health changes that occur through life, higher rates of depression and inflammatory diseases because they were abused, because their gene instruction got changed. And those gene instructions will be passed along to their children. Are they responsible for that? No, the person who abused them is responsible for that.
Exactly, exactly. It keeps coming back to personal responsibility here. No matter how far afield I wander with you, you keep bringing me back to the fact that, hey, we have a choice in this matter. We are not simply victims riding along on a pilotless airplane, am I right?
We each have responsibility for the choices we make in governance of ourselves, and we have the capacity to exercise that governance.
Boy, that is good news. We're talking with Dr. Jennings here about the Ten Commandments and how they apply to brain health. This is kind of a strange way of looking at it, but we're finding out that this happens over and over again, that when God says something, when God speaks to us, he is speaking to us not only as a God who loves us, but also as a scientist who understands us, understands our brains and whatnot. This is pretty incredible. We have a short break coming up here, Dr. Jennings. When we come back, the third commandment is waiting for us to talk about. This is one that a lot of people don't quite get. They don't quite understand how this fourth commandment works. The third commandment works, and we're going to find out about that. It's about taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Let's find out what that is on our return. I want to remind you that there is a website we'd love for you to visit, www.comeandreason.com, www.comeandreason.com. More information with Dr. Jennings. So until we come back in just a moment, stay right where you are.
Here's your daily heartbeat with Dr. James Markham.
Many days I talk to patients in the office and I try to give them a biblical prescription. They might be on all the right medications at the right doses, but I try to give them something new. And the biblical prescription I like to share with you today is let's get outside and take care of the earth. You know, we were originally designed to take care of the earth, to take care of the plants, to take care of the animals. There's something that special happens to our chemistry when we do what God originally planned us to do. He originally planned us to take care of the earth we live in. We also know when we're outside, we activate a chemical, vitamin D, which helps change our chemistry for the good. So one of your biblical treatments for the day to change your chemistry is get outside, take care of the earth, take care of God's creatures, and you'll change your chemistry.
Thank you, Dr. Markham. If you'd like more information, go to heartwiseministries.org. That's heartwiseministries.org.
When we come to a new life with Jesus Christ, because of sin, we bring into the relationship a lot of baggage that we've collected throughout our life. This baggage is often heavy and unbearable. Have you ever come to a turnstile while carrying suitcases in both hands? Even though you might not need your hands to get through the turnstile, you definitely can't get through holding on to the luggage. Well, what do? You have to let go. This is wonderful news in the Christian life. It's not about living in the past. The crucifixion took care of that. We can walk forward without all that baggage. We just need to connect to Christ. Would you like to learn today how to let go of that baggage you're carrying around? Call Life Talk Radio and enroll in the free Discover Bible Study course. All 26 lessons are based on God's Word and will empower you to live the Christian life walking hand in hand with Jesus. Enroll today to begin that stroll with Christ. Call 800-775-HOPE. That's 800-775-4673.
Welcome back to Simple Solutions. I'm your host, Charles Mills. We're here with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. We are going through the Ten Commandments and looking at how God applied them to our brains, what we need to know and how we need to feel and how we need to incorporate this in our thoughts as well as our bodies and in our lives. Dr. Jennings, we're now on the third commandment. I'll read it here from the New International Version, Exodus 20, verse 7. You shall not misuse, and the King James says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, this has a couple of permutations. One, if we actually construct in our mind a construct of God in which we can denigrate him and use his name vilely and foully, then that we can only do that if we don't value him, if we don't esteem him, if we don't look up to him. So he is something that has been debased in our mind. And if we debase God in our mind, then, as we've already talked, then that results back upon us, where we become like that which we admire and serve. And so we become debased by that process. And God cannot avoid God cannot prevent us from reaping the consequences of that, which is a marred and transformed character. So he can't hold us guiltless or prevent us from reaping those consequences. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is when we take the name of Christ or God as a Christian, and we go out and live a life that misrepresents him, and practice principles that are at variance to his character of love and benevolence, and instead we are hard-hearted, we're judgmental, we're critical, we're a gossiper, we're an exploiter, we're a manipulator, but we claim to be Christian. Those practices react upon us, wire our brain in certain ways, develop our character in a character that is opposite to his, and God cannot undo those consequences as long as we continue to take his name in vain and live that lifestyle against his true nature as revealed in Christ. So it's about how it transforms us and warps us away from God's ideal.
You know, I was reading an article the other day about health, and it says how our bodies are the temple of God and we need to put healthy things in our temple and keep our temple clean. I would imagine that our brains are the temple of God too. Am I right?
No, it's all about the brain. All the organs of the body have their primary purpose to keep your brain healthy. That's their purpose. So the health message, the reason to live healthy, the reason to maintain your spirit temple is because God dwells in our hearts and minds through the neural circuits of our brain. It's not through the big toe. It's not through the liver. It's not through the pump in the chest. It's through the neural circuits of the brain. So you're exactly right.
Okay. All right, we now come to a very, very important one, and I know where you're going to go with this one, but I'm sure you're going to surprise us as well. The fourth commandment, I'll read the first couple sentences here. remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. Now, why is God telling us to not work on his holy special day?
Yeah, there's multiple, again, permutations to this one as well. One, there is just the obvious mental and physical health benefit to taking one day and seven, 24 hours aside, where we put aside physical labor and mental labor, where we aren't worried, we aren't stressed, we aren't trying to get all the activities of the week done and get the laundry and all these things done, where we can actually not just rest our bodies with a physical sleep that we get every night, but we can allow our minds to unwind and rest from the cares of the world and be rejuvenated in our time with family and God. There is a physical and mental health benefit that comes from that weekly rest. That is, I think, the most insignificant aspect of the purpose of the Sabbath rest. I think the greater aspect of the Sabbath rest, and what it really means to rest and take a Sabbath rest, is to internalize into one's life the principles upon which the Sabbath was based. And the Sabbath was based in the Garden of Eden at the end of creation week in a context of a universe in which Lucifer had already begun his rebellion and raised allegations that God could not be trusted and was a power monger. And after a week in which God just used incredible displays of power to create a new planet and new intelligent life, God says, universe, I rest. I rest. Take 24 hours aside. Consider all these permutations and allegations and come to your own conclusions. No pressure or coercion for me. True Sabbath rest is not about simply avoiding physical labor one day in seven. True Sabbath rest is internalizing into your heart, as it says in Hebrews, that we have the law written on the heart and mind, the principles of God, so that we present truth in love and leave people free. That's what a Sabbath keeper looks like. Remember those people who put Christ on the cross, wanted him down by sunset so they could go home and observe the Sabbath, yet they just killed the God of the Sabbath. So you can be a Sabbath observer in behavior, but be God's enemy and kill him. So it's more than which day of the week you don't work or you go to church. It has to do with the character you develop that practices its principles of which the Sabbath is invested. Truth presented in love, leaving people free.
I have to say, Dr. Jennings, that I have observed you on the Sabbath day, and you're a hard-working guy on that day, so I'm glad you have put it this way. When you observe Sabbath, when you have your classes, when you give your seminars, are you resting? How can you do that?
Yeah, exactly. Jesus actually said to the Jews in his day, my Father is constantly at work and I work with him, when they were criticizing him for healing on the Sabbath. And they wanted to pick stones up and stone him because they wanted to observe the Sabbath in a forensic and legal type of way, a worker behavior they would do. They had multiple rules, like 490 different rules about what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. And yet none of them were actual Sabbath keepers, because it's not about avoiding certain behaviors. It's about the heart at rest and in union with God and practicing godly principles in your life. That's what it's truly about. And the seventh-day Sabbath itself is so important because it stands as weekly evidence. It would not exist. You understand, the Sabbath would not exist if God were the kind of person Satan alleges. Its weekly existence is every week a giant exclamation point, Satan lied, Satan lied, Satan lied. Every 7 days, Satan lied. Satan lied, because this day would not exist if God used his power to coerce his way.
My, there is so much for us to learn as we look at the Ten Commandments that God handed down, so much for our mind to absorb as well. This is very good. We'll have to work on some more of these commandments a little bit later. I want to remind our listeners that there is a website, www.comeandreason.com. Go visit there. We have a blog and program archives and a lot of resources. If you're a Facebooker, there's a fan page, Come and Reason. Check it out. Become a fan. Join us. Simple Solutions is a production of commonreason.com and airs each week on this station. Share your questions and concerns online at commonreason.com, and then join Dr. Timothy Jennings right here as we search the Bible and look for Bible-based simple solutions God has in mind for us today. We'll be right back. love going there and reading your blogs and whatnot. As the people come and visit with you on that site, are you noticing any kind of threads that are taking place? Any questions that you find repeated over and over again as people search for the God of the universe in a very sinful world?
Yeah, the questions that repeat are about God's character, about the question of punishment, about the purpose of why Christ had to die. People have lots of concerns about how God will treat them and how God treated his son and what Christ has done for us.
Hmm. We are in the dark so many times, Dr. Jennings, on those subjects. How did we get here? Why are we thinking such bad thoughts about God who created us and loves us?
Well, because we have been lied to. We have been lied to as a human race in the Garden of Eden when Eve was lied to by the serpent. But we have been lied through the generations by lots of human agencies, even those who have been given the authority to speak for God himself. If you consider the Jewish nation, which was God's people on earth, and how they misrepresented and lied about God so much so that when he came and stood among them, they hated him and they killed him. And then through the Dark Ages, how the church has misrepresented God, and through tradition and through preconceived ideas, through the pulpits of America, so many lies and distortions are told about God. It's so woven into the fabric of our thinking that even our insurance policies have not covering acts of God, as if God was sending the lightning bolts to hit your house.
Yeah.
So we have these tremendous distortions that are in our thinking about God that only studying the truth as revealed in Scripture can help set us free from.
Is the new generation coming along any better off than the old generation? You know, we used to be the old law and order generation back in the day, but the new ones coming up. You deal with kids from time to time. Are you hopeful or optimistic about the future on this topic?
Well, I think if they come up to ask questions, if they have the attitude of, I don't believe it without evidence, I want something that's rational, reasonable, and sensible, then they will be better off. I think that they do have a certain skepticism and don't just believe blindly like maybe the previous generations have done. However, they also come up in an age in which their minds are being significantly impacted by electronic media, and so their capacity, they may be skeptical, but their capacity to comprehend and learn may be impacted in a negative way based on the heavy amounts of media they may be getting. So I'm not sure if there's an ultimate greater advantage there or not. I think time will tell, and we'll see.
Wow, this is incredible. Well, we have a break coming up here, and on the other side of this, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Timothy Jennings about the Ten Commandments and how they apply to our minds. God doesn't do anything in a simple way. It's very complex. He wants to make sure that everything we do that helps us, helps all of us, our bodies, our minds, and our relationship with him. So we'll take a short break and be back in a minute, so just stay right where you are.
This is Ivan Williams with Brighter Hope. Did you know that faith moves God? Acting on his word before his word even begins to act. Moving ahead not only on what you feel or see, but pure and simply on the authority that God is able, and because he said so, it will happen. I don't know of any farmer who puts their trust in the weatherman or some groundhog. That farmer plants the seed no matter if the groundhog sees his shadow or not. That farmer plants whether the fall predictions of the meteorologists are full of gloom and doom or fair weather. They believe that if you plant, there will be a harvest. You have hope in Jesus Christ.
In 1941, the USO was born. To honor and comfort the men and women of our armed forces around the world. Men and women who have put our dreams and our futures above their own, who protect and defend the freedoms we hold so dear. And burning in every one of their hearts is a singular, undeniable desire to come home, to return to the ones they love, to realize their dreams, to be free and at peace. And so the USO will carry on to touch their spirits, to comfort them, to remind them,
to simply and heartfully thank them for the extraordinary gift they give us all. Wherever and whenever they go, until every brow is soothed and every hand is held, until every song is sung and every battle won, until everyone comes home. To find out more about the USO, visit us at uso.org.
Jesus said in John 14:27, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid." Do you long for that peace in your life? Let's return to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author, Dr. Timothy Jennings.
Welcome back to our program. I'm your host, Charles Mills, along with Dr. Jennings. We're talking about the Ten Commandments today and how God has messages for our minds in there as well, and healing for our minds in each and every one. Our phone lines are open now for your questions and comments. 800-775-4673 is the number. 800-775-4673. Let's head over to Great Britain and talk to Champy. Hi, Champy. What's on your heart today?
Hello.
Hello.
You were just talking about the Sabbath a minute ago, and I was listening to that. And you mentioned that the Sabbath was made for the universe, basically, like it was to represent God's freedom that He gives to everyone, and the universe could learn from that. But didn't Jesus say the Sabbath was made for man? Doesn't that imply that it's for us and not particularly the rest of the universe?
Well, actually, the Bible does say, and Jesus does say, and He's talking to His audience at that time, helping them understand that the Sabbath was made for man. But that doesn't negate the context in which the Sabbath was made. And the context in which it was made was what was happening in the entire universe. And Job tells us that the sons of God sang together for joy when the foundations of the earth were laid. And so they were clearly involved in the observations of what was going on here. And in Isaiah 66, we're told that when all things are made new, that from one new moon to one Sabbath, that all will come and bow down before the Lord. And I think that the Sabbath was clearly made for man. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that its benefit and what it was teaching. Remember, it says in 1 Corinthians 4:9 that we are a lesson book. Earth is a lesson book to angels as well as to men.
Mm-hmm.
And so while the Sabbath was made for man, the lessons we draw from it are not limited to man.
One more thing. God really put harsh rules with the Sabbath as well. It seemed more like coercion to the people rather than freedom and liberty to think and be free and disobey Him. Because if you disobeyed Him, if you were like one of the Israelites, there were some consequences that God imposed on the people, didn't He?
Yeah, and how do you understand that? We understand that as... the children of Israel were God's, if you understand the whole children of Israel theme, they were chosen by God to be His actors in a really cool play with lots of props and costumes. And as with any play, there is a director, it was God, and there's a script that you have to go by. And if you refuse to go by the script, you can't be part of the play anymore. But you didn't have to be a member of the acting troupe. People could leave the nation of Israel. They didn't have to stay as part of the team. And you didn't have to be part of the nation of Israel in order to be saved. We can look at people like Naaman and Nicodemus, and of course people before Abraham, Enoch, and others who were not members of the Jewish nation yet experienced salvation in Old Testament times. So being part of the Jewish nation was not necessary for salvation. The Jewish nation was designed to teach a lesson, and it was a very strict set of instructions that they had to follow in order to carry out the lesson that the theater was designed to teach. And so, yes, you find that they deviated from the theme that they were often dealt with quite harshly.
So when the Bible says stuff like, do not seek after your own pleasures on the Sabbath, is that for us as well today, or is it for them?
Well, in Isaiah 58, actually, it says that the Sabbath is to be called a delight. And if you're not delighting and enjoying yourself on the Sabbath, then you're not observing it. So what it's talking about in the text that you referred is about being selfish. It's saying you're not to be selfish on the Sabbath. Well, actually, as we come to have the law of love written in our hearts and minds, we're not to be selfish any day of the week, and then we understand that the Sabbath is more than just a 24-hour period in time. It goes back to what I was saying before the break, that real Sabbath observance is about having written on the law in the heart and mind, where we are people who present truth and love and leave people free. That Sabbath observance extends to well beyond a 24-hour period each day of the week.
All right. Well, thank you, Chappie, for your call. We appreciate that.
Thanks for the questions. Great questions. And keep thinking.
Very good questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right. 800-775-4673. Very insightful stuff. 800-775-4673. Let's talk to Kathy in New Mexico. Hi, Kathy.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I am fine. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. I just got the tail end of the program, but I heard that you're talking about the Ten Commandments, and I have a comment to make because I've been dealing with a person in my family who married into my family who is a non-believer, I have tried the Ten Commandments with this person who can be very arrogant and haughty. And this person doesn't respond to anything. So I've been, you know, I hit a bottom with this, and I just said, God, why is this person in our family, you know? Why did they come into our family, and, you know, what should I do? You know, I can't continue. He's made me a target. And I said, I can't continue with this. And I tried anger and everything, and that doesn't work. So I got the message from Jesus. It was a picture I saw of him bound before Pilate. And, of course, we know before Herod, he was silent. He was silent because Herod was a wicked man. I'm not saying this person is wicked, but I'm just saying the power of silence. Mm. And I got the message from Jesus to be silent, that silence has power when all else fails. And in that silence, Jesus can work. And it's very profound because I've been dealing with this, and I know it's not from my mind, but I've been praying and praying for an answer. And then also I got that this is like a school. It's preparing me because I'm a writer and I'm writing about something controversial. Well, not so controversial, but I'm kind of putting myself out there as to you know, when I went down a wrong path and then when I found again the right path, that kind of thing. So I'm putting myself out there for a lot of ridicule and criticism. And it's like he's preparing me for ridicule and criticism with this person in dealing with it Jesus' way, you know, when all else fails.
Did you have a question for us today?
No, that was my comment. Maybe it'll help someone else who's up against the same thing, because you can use all the Christian principles, and when they fail with the non-believer, this person believes Allah is God. And when they fail with a non-believer, I'm not saying because he's a non-believer, but this person is raised without compassion, without respect.
Well, those are very insightful words, Kathy. We appreciate
person,
that.
Jesus isn't going to be able to work. So
no,
in silence.
No.
My response to this person is silence, then Jesus can work.
Absolutely, and that's certainly how Jesus handled Herod. He just was silent. Dr. Jennings, have you ever used silence as a treatment?
Well, silence can be helpful in multiple settings, and depending on what you're trying to achieve. Sometimes people need silence in order for them to reflect and think on the comments that have been made and the truths that have been presented, and that we need to be silent to let them process and consider and contemplate and meditate and let the Holy Spirit work. Jesus used silence with Herod and Pilate, however, because their minds had been closed, and there was no opportunity for truth. And he wasn't using silence as a means to reach them. He would have spoken if there was any opportunity to reach them. So they had closed their minds and hearts and wouldn't hear or listen to anything, so Jesus didn't waste his energy because there was nothing he could do to reach them at that point. So he remained silent at that point. Jesus remained silent with his apostles for a different reason. He says, I have much to tell you, but you can't bear it. And so he remained silent. It didn't tell them all that he wanted to tell them, not because their hearts were closed, they weren't, but because they weren't prepared to handle the light and the truth that he wanted to share with them. So wisdom will sometimes keep quiet because we may know something that a person would be overwhelming for their psychology or their maturity level. Just a simple example, why we remain silent on sexual education when kids are a certain age, because they can't handle that education at that time. So we remain silent on that and educate later when they're more mature and can handle it. And so there is absolutely a place for silence in dealing with people. So yes, I think it can be quite appropriate.
Well, very good. Sometimes silence is golden. Kathy, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate that. 800-775-4673 is our phone number if you have a question or comment. 800-775-4673. Let's continue on now with how God was trying to heal the mind with the Ten Commandments. Kind of an interesting twist on this. Let's go to commandment number 5, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. What kind of healing for the mind can we find in this commandment, Dr. Jennings?
Yeah, in every one of these commandments, if you really think it through, that you notice that these are really outlining a God's design template for life and how he designed us, which are the law of love. You see, when the honoring the mother and father, our primary template for human relationships is the relationship in which a child to parents. This is where we learn about love, about connectedness, about trust, about a sense of peace and security, about affirmation, about acceptance. Relationship dynamics, the primary template upon which we learn how to relate is our parental-child relationships. And so God is saying, honor your mother and father. Don't be rebellious. Don't be conflictual. Don't grow up in a stress and hostile environment. Don't harbor in your heart resentment, bitterness, hostility against your parents. Because to harbor that in your heart won't hurt them. It will hurt you. What will happen is if you harbor that kind of stuff in your heart, you will activate your stress cascade. Your stress cascade will activate inflammatory factors in your body. The inflammatory factors will cause worse physical health. You won't live as long on the earth. Not only that, if you harbor that resentment and you don't move past it, you will be less trustful of others. So in your future relationships, you will be suspicious. You will be vulnerable to being hurt, and you will experience slights and injuries where none occurred, because and that will cause you to be angry, and you will have conflicts in your ongoing relationships, will only cause more stress, and thus you will have a shorter life on the earth. If, however, you work through, even if your parents have made shortcomings and mistakes, but you work through them and you forgive in your heart and you have peace and don't hold bitterness and resentment against your parents, you will have showed maturity in developing of your character. So when conflicts come in the future relationships, you show maturity in being able to work through those. You retain a sense of well-being and peace in your heart. Your inflammatory cascade isn't kicked up. You will live longer on the earth if you learn to do this.
This is pretty amazing stuff. We sometimes look at God's Ten Commandments and think of them as rules to live by, but actually they're rules to think by, and that's very, very important for us to know. Again, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments, 800-775-4673. We move now to the next commandment here, and it would seem to me that this would be very obvious. You shall not murder. I can understand that, Doctor. It's not good for the body, not good for the mind, but are there some things in here we need to hear from you about some more complex issues that this addresses?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. That when we kill another human being, we damage ourselves significantly. There's an immense amount of stress and anxiety. We may do this impulsively. We may do it premeditatedly. People who do it may do it with anger or rage. People may do this in combat situations. As you know, I was trained in the U.S. Army and a former military psychiatrist. And one of the things they teach us is that post-traumatic stress disorder in a combat setting is a normal response to an abnormal situation. It is not normal for us to be killing other human beings. The brain is not wired, nor designed, nor created for it to be at peace in killing another human being. If something significantly goes wrong in the stress cascade when we kill another human being, or we're in a situation in which people are trying to kill us. Right. Those types of things cause damage to our psyche, as well as our neurobiology and our physiology. So yes, it's pretty, I think, straightforward, as you said.
And, you know, as I hear you say this, a lot of us think that God is trying to kill us. If we do something wrong, if we break one of these commandments, God is standing there with the hellfires ready to zap us. So we are actually living with post-traumatic syndrome in our lives. Am I right?
As soon as Adam and Eve believed the lies about God, they ran and hid because they were afraid. And man has been living in fear and insecurity, which causes them to become self-referenced and self-focused, watching out for number one, survival of the fittest, dog-eat-dog world, constantly in conflict, constantly afraid you're not going to get your own, constantly afraid you won't get respected, won't get valued, won't get the job that you wanted, won't get the position you've longed for, won't get the boyfriend, won't get the girlfriend, constantly living in fear so that we're constantly angling, working to get number one, which only incites more fear as we have to go against somebody else and compete for somebody else. They might retaliate against us. So there's this vicious cycle downward. The only solution, perfect love, casts out all fear.
Oh, yeah.
That love we cannot generate by a force of will. It is a gift of God as we come to trust Him. He pours His love into our hearts, it says in Romans 5:5, and we are transformed so that we begin to minister to others. We give of ourselves to benefit other people. And in so doing, we experience peace and joy, and our fear is taken away.
What a wonderful thought. Dr. Jennings, this may be new to some people. God is not out to kill us. God is out to save us. Satan is out to kill us, but God is out to save us. And the God we worship is a God of life and love. We need to embrace that. I think that'll do some good things for our psyche too, wouldn't you say?
There's 100% good science behind that. When you worship a God of love, the regions of your brain that correspond to love grow stronger and directly calm the fear centers of your brain, with resulting in lower heart rate, lower blood pressure, lower stress hormones, better health. Just as the Bible says, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. This only comes when we meditate and worship a God of love. Worshipping any other God concept, an angry, wrathful, punitive, punishing, distant, authoritarian God, we get more fear and anxiety, and we don't get those health benefits.
Wow. Wow. Okay, moving on to the next one. Now, I can tell you right now that you're going to give us another text. You shall not commit adultery. What's that got to do with the mind, Dr. Jennings?
Well, in Matthew 5, Jesus said, you say if you commit adultery, bad behavior, you commit sin. I say if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. Adultery is primarily about the heart and mind, not about the body. We, when it comes to sex, focus on the body. God focuses on the heart and mind. What's happening in the individual? We, in our narrow-minded focus, hear of a woman who gets raped, a 16-year-old girl who gets raped. Well, what does our mind think? She's no longer a virgin. What does God think? She's still a virgin. Because it's not about the body, it's about the heart. She has not betrayed her vow. She has not betrayed her morals. She has not given herself away. She is still pure in heart, pure in mind. She's still a virgin. And this is the distortion that Satan wants us to think and focus on. It's primarily about the body, but it's not. It's about the heart and mind. And adultery includes betrayal with the body, but adultery extends beyond betrayal with the body. It really entails betrayal with the heart, when we give our heart and affections to others. And this is why the Jewish nation in the Old Testament was constantly called an adulterous nation or adulterous people, because they were giving their hearts to false gods.
Going back to the boy-girl thing, when does attraction become adultery? You're walking down the street, Dr. Jennings, and this good-looking woman's coming towards you, and your mind automatically goes, whoa, good-looking woman. When does that become adultery, if she happens to be married to somebody?
Yes, I don't think there's sin in a recognition of God's beauty in creation. You look out and you see a beautiful sunset, you see a beautiful flower, you see a beautiful waterfall, and you say that's beautiful. You see a beautiful human being, male or female, and you say, wow, they're beautiful. That is not adultery at all. Adultery is when you begin to lust in a selfish way towards that person, and you begin to want to possess them in your mind, and you begin to fantasize about taking them in some either, and it doesn't have to be sexual. It doesn't. It could be in some dominated, controlling capacity where you try to possess them and make them yours as your slave of some kind. That would be equally harmful and sinful as well, but it could be sexual, of course, as well. But it's when you in your mind begin to act or fantasize and choose in your heart that that's what you want to do with that person, then it's no longer observing somebody who's beautiful and appreciating them in the freedom of their God-given individuality. It's when you try to take possession and own them in your heart and mind. And exploit them in some way. That's when it becomes adultery.
All right. Very interesting. Listener, I want to make sure that you have opportunity to talk to Dr. Jennings today if you are so inclined. Here's the number, 800-775-4673. That's 800-775-4673. 4673. I'm enjoying this program very much, Dr. Jennings. Wonderful words here. All right, the next commandment, you shall not steal. Are we talking about breaking into someone's house and taking their coin collection?
Stealing of all kinds. It certainly includes those obvious forms of stealing, but you can steal someone's reputation with gossip, and that's a form of theft as well. You can steal credit for someone else's achievements. That's a form of theft as well. Stealing can have multiple permutations, and it's really a dishonest practice of taking for yourself that which does not belong to you, which is at its root, which all of these breaches are, if you notice, selfishness, seeking to put self ahead at the exploitation of others, which is the opposite of love, which love is giving of self to promote the benefit of others. And so whenever we break any of these commandments, we activate the fear circuits and the selfish circuits in our brains and make those attributes stronger in our character, and we move ourselves further and further away from God's design for us. And this is why breaching these things is damaging. This is why obeying them, however, is healing, because we practice the principles of love, we activate those circuits, and they grow stronger.
I want to make sure that something is very clear here. I think I've heard you give this illustration before. If a toddler, if a one-year-old or one-and-a-half-year-old gets up, goes across the room, and takes a toy out of the hands of a friend and walks over there and starts playing with it, that child really hasn't stolen. You wouldn't say, ooh, you just stole. If you went over to that child and said, ooh, honey, you just stole, can that child understand that stealing, or does stealing require something other than the act?
Yeah, I think stealing, it requires an awareness of the what's yours and what's not yours. You have to have boundaries. First off, you have to have the awareness of what where you end and someone else begins as a human being and a person. And small children actually have a difficult time telling where they begin and where someone else ends. So they have the individual identity boundary issues. And then after individual identity boundary issues, they have to understand where such concepts as property and belonging and ownership and mine and yours and all those things. So at a certain age, there isn't the capacity to even steal, because there's not an awareness of any differentiation between me and somebody else and property and so forth. So, yeah.
You know, I have a perfect illustration to go along with this. It came from my dad. When he was just a little boy, maybe 3 or 4 years old, he was walking with his mom down a road in Hinsdale, Illinois, near Chicago. And they went by a construction site, and there was a big pile of sand. And so my dad, being 3 or 4 years old, went over there and jumped in the sand, had a good time. And so mom sort of stood off to one side waiting, and when they were done, they started walking, continuing their walk. And then my dad's mother looked down at him and said, Bobby, what's in your hands? And the little boy spread his little hands out, and there was sand caked on his sand. And Bobby said, this is sand, Mommy. And they said, is that your sand? And Bobby thought for a minute. And then the mother said something I will never forget that has been with me all my life. She said to her son, Bobby, that's someone else's sand. You need to put it back. And that little 3-year-old went toddling back to that sand pile and brushed off every grain of sand onto that pile and then left happily, understanding where he ended and someone else began. And my dad has been a treasurer of conferences and unions and divisions all his life, and that money has not ever been in safer hands than in my dad's. Pretty good lesson, Dr. Jennings, do you think?
Yeah, I think knowing those boundaries and knowing what's yours and what's not someone else's and not wanting to take someone else's is an excellent lesson, absolutely.
Wow, okay. All right, the next commandment here, we just have a few minutes left, we'll get through to these. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. This is lying, this is telling an untruth. What's that got to do with the brain?
Same type thing. When you misrepresent somebody, then you and you start telling lies or of any kind, then you live in fear that you're going to be exposed. You live in fear that the truth will come out and you will be exposed, and then that activates your fear circuits, which activates the entire stress cascade, which has all this negative consequences on you. And of course, it also requires you to begin warping your reason so that you can justify the lie that you're telling. And ultimately, some people actually come to believe their lies, and that causes further damage.
This final commandment, Dr. Jennings, the 10th commandment, I'm looking at them here, murdering and committing adultery and stealing and false testimony, these are all physical acts. They can be physical acts. But this next one really is built for the brain. It says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or his maidservant, his ox or his donkey, that would mean his car or his boat, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. To covet something is a mental act, am I right?
That's exactly right, and this really goes to God's design for humanity and what God is focusing on. Again, we focus on behavior. God focuses on the heart and mind. In 2 Corinthians 10, 3-5, we're told that we should bring every thought into captivity to Jesus Christ. What we have discovered with neuroscience and brain science is that if you do acts behaviorally, you activate certain neural circuits, and if you activate those neural circuits, it releases enzymes which create which cause proteins to be formed, which will cause those neural circuits to grow stronger. Basically, like with exercise, if you exercise a muscle, that muscle gets stronger. If you exercise a neural circuit, that neural circuit gets stronger. But what we found is that you don't actually have to exercise the circuit behaviorally. For instance, playing a piano piece activates certain neural circuits, but you can exercise those neural circuits in your imagination. And so if you imagine yourself doing these things in your imagination, you fire the same neural circuits, cause those same strengthening of those neural circuits, and so you don't change in character even if you're not doing it in behavior. This is why we are not to covet. This is why we are not to do these things. So...
So according to that verse we heard about, you know, committing adultery in your heart, as far as God is concerned, if we think it and don't do it, we're still sinning.
This is because sin is a matter of being outside of harmony of the principles of which health and life are based upon. And when we talk about firing these neural circuits, for instance, we can lock somebody in a pedophile up in a prison, and he can't act on his pedophilia, but he can imagine acting on those things, and in fantasy and in mind do those things, and so the exact same neural circuits will be firing if he's doing it in his mind, and so even 10 years in prison, he can come out worse of a pedophile than he went in, because if he spent his years fantasizing, planning, and participating in his mind in those activities. This is why we have to bring all of our thoughts into captivity to Jesus Christ, because only as we change our thinking does the brain rewire itself.
Wow. I am getting a much better picture here of what God had in mind for my mind when he gave those Ten Commandments. Dr. Jennings, this is amazing, and I really appreciate that. We're coming up to the close of our program. Dr. Jennings, for those who are listening who may struggle with the Ten Commandments in their mind or physically, do you have some words of encouragement and some advice for them of how they can begin making the change of mind and body to keep their lives in tune with what God has in mind for them?
It's a matter of developing a heart attitude of which you want to pursue the truth. You pursue the truth, and as you pursue the truth, you apply the truth to your life. So it's not truth understood, but it's truth applied. Ultimately, the truth leads us back to God, and we are won back by the weight of evidence that God can be trusted. And we open our heart to him and ask him to come in to further enlighten and transform and ennoble and enable. And we begin exercising our power of choice in harmony with the truth that we understand, and then asking God for the strength to follow through with those choices.
I guess we could say that, you know, sin becomes easier as you do it. But can we also say that obedience becomes easier, living in line with God's love becomes easier as we do it?
There's no question, because we fire the healthy neural circuits, and as they grow stronger, then they become new habits for us, and we will do things of a healthy nature because it is normal and habitual and in harmony with our own characters and consciences. Yes, it becomes easier with time.
Wow. That is good news. That is encouraging words. Dr. Jennings, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I want to remind you, listener, that there is a website, www.comeandreason.com. Check it out. There's a blog there, program archives, resources, his book, Could It Be This Simple? And if you're a Facebooker, check out our fan page, Come and Reason. Until next week, this is Charles Mills, along with Dr. Timothy Jennings, inviting you to apply the simple solutions God placed in your heart today. Goodbye, everyone.
Simple Solutions is a production of Life Talk Radio and Dr. Timothy Jennings, and is made possible by your generous support. For more information, visit www.comeandreason.com.